Welcome to the Monogamous Marriage Podcast. We're Kate and Liam, married bisexuals a decade into our non-monogamous journey.
We've been having sex with our friends for 10 years, and we're still madly in love with each other.
We're the authors of the Monogamous Marriage blog, where we've been overthinking sex and love since 2016. This podcast is the place where we process our sexual adventures in real time.
We are not experts, and nothing we say should be mistaken for professional advice. This show contains mature language and sexual content, so if you're under 18, it isn't for you. But if you're a fellow overthinker and you're not freaked out by unfiltered conversation, you're going to feel right at home.
Today we're going to be talking about a category of substances I'll call intoxicants. So for us, that's mainly going to be alcohol, which we're going to talk about in the first part, and drugs in the second part. Drugs meaning mainly cannabis, MDMA, and magic mushrooms. And it's important to state before we start that we aren't experts. So this is not the podcast to come to if you're thinking about getting responsible, healthy information about a substance you're considering trying. We are not experts. We have not consulted with experts. What we're here to do, rather, is something I think is also important, which is just to tell our story of our interactions with these things.
Okay, so I think probably like so many stories, we need to go way back to the beginning.
Yes, so I think so too.
Both of us grew up in the church, and the overwhelming message from religion was that drugs are bad, alcohol is bad, don't do it.
Right. I remember in our hymnal, the Baptist hymnal, so if you were at all affiliated with the Southern Baptist movement, you saw this in the back of the hymnal. It was a statement of faith that all churches adhered to, and included in that was the command to abstain from the sale and use of intoxicating drinks. So yeah. I don't know what else they considered that you might use it for besides a beverage, medicine, but that was such a pillar of that life. They didn't make a special point about murder, but they made a special point about drinking alcohol.
Right. Yeah. So in my family, there was never a drop of alcohol at any family gatherings. In fact, at my first wedding when I was 20 years old, I had a completely dry wedding. We didn't even have a champagne toast. We had a sparkling apple juice toast.
Yes. And that was my experience too. Growing up, our house, there was no alcohol. In fact, when I would go to someone else's house and there was alcohol, it almost seemed like they might have had like a St. Andrew's cross in the living room.
Like they were degenerates.
Just, even though these were wonderful people, I knew they weren't, but a part of my brain reacted in that way because I'd been so strongly indoctrinated against alcohol. So let me ask you a question. When you were, let's just say 17, so clearly underage for drinking, were you curious about it? Were you looking forward to being able to drink? What was your mindset?
Well, I guess there's a little bit of curiosity because it seemed to be something that so many people enjoyed doing, but I think that was overwhelmed by fear. Mm-hmm. And I was always afraid of going to a party because I didn't want to have to say no to the offer of alcohol or drugs.
But if you didn't say no, if you said yes, were you afraid of the consequences, or you were afraid of just being a bad girl or breaking God's command or whatever you happened to believe at the time?
I guess it was just a fear of breaking the rules and getting in trouble.
Right.
I guess I wasn't worried about it doing anything to me.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I actually feared the consequences. Mm-hmm. I thought that every human being is a potential alcoholic, and you don't know, you might be one of those people for whom one drop sets you on an irreversible course to complete desolation. So I actually was afraid of it. I had no desire to try alcohol at all, which I know makes me a big exception among teenagers.
Well, and to this day, you maintain that you don't want to drink alcohol. So that never actually changed.
Right. But I remember, too, a part of it for me was just the taste. So I accidentally, at a party, drank a mouthful of what I thought was orange juice, but it was vodka and orange juice. So good news for all the teenagers at the party, except for me, I spat it out. I didn't realize it was alcohol at first. I thought it was the worst orange juice I had ever tasted. I felt like it had been mixed with battery acid. So that just confirmed in me the indoctrination that I had received, that alcohol was to be avoided under any circumstance.
Because it tasted yucky?
Because it would lead to ruin, and it tasted yucky.
Okay. So when my first husband and I were married, we started to drink a little bit. So, mm-hmm. you know, we'd occasionally have a rum and coke or something. But it wasn't till I was in my 30s with my second husband that I started getting into wine. And so he was a chef, and it was important for the experience of the meal that you also have wine be part of that. So I actually became a kind of a wine connoisseur. I mean, not at a high level. I'm not a sommelier or anything, but I really got into wine and its interactions with food and how it could augment the flavors of different meals. So that was really my main introduction to the world of alcohol. So when we got together, the fact that you didn't drink made me feel like, oh, we at least have to introduce you to wine for right. the same kind of reasons. Like, we need to have a full experience of a nice meal together. So my project was to introduce you to a bunch of different kinds of wine.
Yes. Well, I really remember committing for, I think, a period of 4 years to trying to learn to like wine, because I liked everything about wine. I liked the history. I liked the nuanced appreciation that people brought to it. Just the flavor. And then still probably a religious hangover in terms of what the consequences might be that stayed with me. But I tried. I tried every drink that you handed to me, and every single mouthful tasted like medicine to me. Not one moment of pleasure. And I remember thinking at the time that, you know, so many people love alcohol. So when you say, hey, we're going to have an open bar at this event, everyone goes, yay, open bar. That's great. So when I think about what the reasons would be, it's probably not taste. So it's probably not people saying, wow, I'm going to have an amazing flavor experience at the open bar. There's something that alcohol changes in the mind, in the human system, that is the thing that makes people go, I want more of that. So I remember saying one night, I am going to find out what's on the other side. This process of taking a drink here and taking a drink there certainly isn't working. But maybe if I get to that altered state, I'll realize, oh, that's the thing that everyone loves. So this happened to be a night where we were doing a real sexual experiment. You were having a one-on-one time with another guy, and we decided that I would sit in the room and observe but not participate. But I just thought, this is the night I am going to just keep drinking until I get to amazing land. And so...
So rather than trying to like the taste, you're just going to try like to like the experience of intoxication.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going for. So I sat there, you're doing your thing, he's doing his thing, and I'm drinking.
You drank an entire bottle of red wine.
Was it really an entire bottle?
Very close.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't even know. Is a bottle a lot? I don't know. Probably it sounds like a lot. So anyway...
It's a lot for a newbie.
Yeah. And I was the dictionary definition of a newbie. So I drank and drank and drank. And then it was all over. And it was time for him to go. And we said our goodbyes. And I'm walking down the stairs. And I notice, oh, I'm feeling wobbly. So there's a physiological reaction. I'm not feeling anything like elation or relaxation. But my legs are feeling wobbly. Once he gets out the front door and I have what I think is called in the medical world, projectile vomitus. I just threw up. I was breathing 1 second, and then the next breath, the contents of my stomach came flying out with the next exhalation.
It was the craziest vomiting episode I've ever seen, because if you have ever vomited, almost everyone, I would say it's almost a universal, is that you kind of bend over at the waist, right? Right. There's a pulling in of the stomach as your stomach clenches. This man's walking down the stairs in front of me, and without even a hint of a bend over, he's just standing straight up. Red wine spews out of his mouth like a fountain.
Yeah.
And then instead of running to the sink, which is, again, what almost every other person would do, you just stand there and puke again. So there were two shoots of vomit, and it was remarkable.
Yeah, well, that's a very nice word to use for it. I was in shock, frankly. I think that's why I just stood there. I didn't know what was happening. I'm used to the, oh, I'm getting sick. My stomach feels terrible. I think things are going to be coming up. Should I go to the washroom? There was none of the warning that I usually get. It was just like, everything's okay. My legs are wobbly. Bam! There it goes.
It was crazy.
It was crazy.
So but that was the end of the experiment.
Yeah, because I did. I answered my question. I got all the way to the max, and never once on the journey did I experience anything that I would say was a positive mental state.
Yeah. So I would say at this stage in our lives, you have made your decision about alcohol. It is no longer of interest to you. You are just not a drinker until the day you die.
Right. Well, I had made a decision in 2018, which was just after this time, that I would change my diet because I had a big sugar problem. So actually, since July 11th, 2018, I have not had a drop of anything besides H2O.
Way to go.
Yeah. So that's not saying that people should or that it's a terrible thing to drink. It was just the right thing for me.
Yeah. And for me, I've never been a big drinker, actually. So for a long time, I would have some wine with a meal out. And then there were a couple of years when I was having wine almost every night, just one glass of wine with my dinner. And then I realized that's probably more than I should be drinking. You know, my doctor said, how many drinks do you have in a week? And I said, well, you know, like maybe 8 or 9, you know, one per night during the week and a couple on the weekends. And and she said, you know, that's actually, according to our chart, within problem drinking zone. And I was like, oh, well, shit. Okay. So because I do have addiction in my family, I thought I'm going to pull that back and just make sure I can. And it wasn't too hard. The first few weeks, I missed it a little bit with my weekly meals, but it's now quite easy. I don't crave alcohol at all. So I have some wine on the weekends. If we go to a party, I might have a cider or a mixed drink. But basically, I just drink a little bit on the weekends.
Right. But there is an exception to that. And that is when we go to, say, a lifestyle event, like Naughty Jim's Be Better at Being Bad at Hedonism. And I am not counting by any stretch of the imagination, but you have a lot more than a couple of drinks.
Yeah, for sure. I certainly don't, you know, start early in the day or anything. Some people have their mimosas with breakfast and then just keep going all day long. I am not that. I can't tolerate that kind of alcohol use anymore. And if I ever could. But yeah, definitely at Hedo, I was drinking every day, you know, 3, 4, 5 drinks easily.
Right.
And I am getting to an age, I am 47 now, where I just can't process it very well. Right. So I get hungover faster and I just feel run down and icky the next day. So I have tried to cut back on that as well. And we'll talk about some of the other intoxicants I've subbed in so that I can continue to have that slightly altered, slightly lightened feel, but not have the ill effects of alcohol.
Right. So this brings up the point that I really want to talk about, which is, why is alcohol so central to the lifestyle? And I guess the two possible answers are, people are using it to numb their moral judgment. They're doing something that they know is wrong, and they're just trying to get past that to indulge in a guilty pleasure. Or they are trying to combat social indoctrination that they received as children that was very sex negative and get to a more sex positive place. So the alcohol is actually helping them be their truer selves by breaking down some of those barriers. So what do you think is going on?
Well, those two things sound very similar to me. Both of them are, alcohol is helping them overcome either their moral issues or their social issues. But I think it's probably...
But can I say something? One is, alcohol is helping you do something bad. Mm-hmm. And the other is, alcohol is helping you do something good.
Right. Yeah. But I think you can see this effect everywhere you go. So whether you're at a wedding or any other kind of celebration or party socially, people will drink more there than they do in their regular lives, because it helps to break down whatever social anxiety you might have. It makes you feel more free and open, less worried about judgment. You know, it's a depressant. So if you're in a slightly elevated, stressed anxious place. It'll bring you down. It takes away your inhibition. So if you're feeling nervous about getting naked on the beach at Hedo or, you know, going to that orgy, those inhibitions will be lessened with alcohol. So for the same reasons we indulge in alcohol in other social situations, I think it's helpful in lifestyle situations. It just helps you to feel less self-conscious.
Right. Do you also think there's something socially going on, like it's a bonding ritual for other people?
Yeah. So how does it feel for you to be the one abstainer quite often in a group?
Right. Well, as a person, I'm not only used to doing things differently, it's actually part of my self-image. So every time everyone else has a drink and I don't, every time someone comes around with shots and looks at me and I do that little nod no and they move on, I'm actually reinforcing my view of who I am as a person, which may be flattering or may not be flattering.
So as the person who's quite often sober at the party, what downsides have you seen in lifestyle situations to alcohol use?
Well, there's certainly an upside for me because I like being the cool observer. I mean cool, not in the sense of like what an awesome person, but just a little bit detached. So you might say that's a weakness, and there's a very good argument to make that it is a weakness. But I do enjoy that position. So I'm not getting lost in the moment. I am able to sit back and observe. So I like that.
I would say that that's actually one of the things that has been difficult for you is that you don't have that ability to just let go and be a little bit out of your mind in the moment.
Right.
You're so coolly analytical and observant that you find it very difficult to get into that situation. And if you had a little bit of that disinhibiting alcohol, it might actually be helpful to you.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because it gets to that issue of relating to groups or relating to individuals. And I've clearly come down on the side that of being a person who wants to connect with people as individuals. So the way I think of it often is, you know, there's a group, they're in the pool at a resort or wherever, and something gets said and everyone goes, woo! I just did it. I wasn't even sure if I knew how to do woo! Because I never say it. I have a body reaction against that. And it's kind of like my flavor of antisocial, which is
elitism.
That's an unflattering way to put it. I admire you when I see you in that situation, but I don't feel a need to also be that person myself. So I'm talking about this as an outsider looking into the world of drinking from a remove. But what do you feel as an insider? What negatives have you seen? Maybe you're more attuned to it than I am because you know what the temptations might be.
Well, I actually didn't hear you say anything that was negative. It's just you see people partying and feel like, I don't want to be part of that.
I definitely see people who, I guess you could create two categories. So when you drink more than usual, when you're somewhat intoxicated, you're a marvel to be around. You're funny, lighthearted, and maybe just more of the positive things in your personality. But that is not how it goes for everyone who drinks. So I also see people who become really kind of nasty. So we've traveled with people like that. We've had them at our parties where you see, wow, there's a real fun group here that is kind of feeling tipsy. And then there's a person who is really letting their negativity flow. So I've definitely seen that. I've seen people making bad decisions, clearly because they're drunk. And then there's that general unattractiveness where you see someone, I don't know whether it's because the feeling is that they have lost control and that a certain level of control is essential to who we are as human beings, or at least as adults. So we had a friend who came with us to Italy. We were going to be part of the marriage of friends of ours. And she was a person who was really smart and delightful when not drinking. But when she drank, a whole different side came out. And I remember two things. One, she was at a party at our house, and you said, oh, I like to be spanked. And she said, I like to spank. And so she started at, you know, if you think of there being a scale and spanking from 1 to 10, she started at 12. Like it was an extremely violent connection. Then we heard later in the evening that she had been kind of ranting to someone else. And then on the trip to Italy, there's one moment that I remember. She was trying to interest someone in having sex. And she said, I didn't pay $2,000 to come to Europe to fuck my husband. And it was like, whoa, where did that come from? There was a lot of spite in the statement too. You remember that?
Yeah. So I think in that disinhibiting process, you know, you're going to see the real person come out.
Right.
So for people like me who get more fun and loving and touchy and want to dance, that's the real me.
Right.
And it takes away from me some of the social anxiety that makes me very self-aware and kind of in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows the fun, lighthearted self that's under that stuff to come out. But for her, it could be that she's got a lot of anger and resentment just beneath the surface. And maybe there are some issues with her husband. Who knows? But that also allows that stuff to come out. So when you take the lid off, you never know what's going to come out. So you've got to be careful.
Right. Would you say that's what you see from the inside, so to speak?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, there's an acceptable level of intoxication, right? So if you have two or three drinks, you're going to get that social lubrication effect. You're not going to be too sloppy drunk, but you're going to feel more open and more talkative. And there's probably a place in there around the 2 to 3 drink range where I feel comfortable and happy and like I can party. But there are lots of people who push it too far and get sloppy. And, you know, there's a person in the hot tub at Hedonism, and she couldn't speak. She could hardly walk.
Right.
And I was actually concerned for her health. Like she should not be in the hot tub in that state.
No,
she was alone.
You think she might slip under the water and drown if no one was there to notice.
Yeah. So I went over to her and kind of tapped her on the shoulder, asked if she was okay, gave her a glass of water, asked, you know, where's your partner? And she couldn't really answer me, but she took the water. So there are people like that who are so anxious about the situation that they just overcompensate by having way too much alcohol. And those people are not going to be in a position to give consent to have sex.
Right.
So obviously that's the biggest negative in the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And it's an unflattering portrait of people. When you get to that sloppy drunk stage, when you're falling all over yourself and saying inappropriate things,
right,
it's not sexy.
Right.
So I think there, like everything, there is a moderation that's required and a certain level of responsible use that can make it fun or can, if you're not being responsible with it, can make it problematic.
Yeah. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, we're going to talk about drugs in a bit, but even alcohol is a very powerful substance. And you mentioned earlier that you've got alcohol problems in your family. And maybe it's worth talking about that because it goes without saying that alcohol has ruined lives. And you've seen that from a very close distance.
Yeah. My sister is an alcoholic and she started very young. I think she had her first drink when she was 13. And that was because she was molested.
Yes.
And was trying to cope. And she never stopped drinking. And so now she's a few years younger than me and she's dying. So her liver and kidneys have both failed and there's a good potential that she's not going to make it through this. And that is what alcohol can do.
Right.
It's a hard thing to see up close because people like me can use alcohol in moderation in small amounts and can control our use. But there are other people who, like my sister, are just not physically capable of using it a little bit, right? They have a taste and then that is just opening the floodgates for more and more and more. So yeah, it's unfortunate that some of us are prone to that kind of addiction and that is an illness. And then some of us are lucky enough to not have that kind of addictive drive.
Right. Well, it's like that thing I thought at an immature level when I was young that, you know, certain people and maybe you will be the one who takes a drop and then can't stop drinking. And it turns out that there are people like that, but it's not because of a failure. It's not because of a weakness. It's not because of a genetic predisposition, I don't think. The big common denominator seems to be trauma. Mm-hmm. And if you have experienced what your sister experienced as a very young person, it's going to be hard for you not to continue drinking, because drinking does provide you a relief from something that no one should have to have gone through. As you may know, Kate started a travel company in 2023 committed to organizing a different kind of lifestyle experience based on bringing small groups of non-monogamous couples to European destinations of cultural and historical interest.
Yeah, so for us, we enjoy the big hotel takeovers and the resorts. They're fun, but we were looking for a different way to do lifestyle travel. And for us, the most important thing is making connections with other people. And it can be hard when you're screaming at each other drunkenly over bass music.
Right.
So we conceived of a way to bring together our two loves, the lifestyle and that community, and travel to interesting places. And so last year we took our first trip to Crete, and it was an amazing success. Mm-hmm. And so this year we're going back to Crete, June 8th to 15th, and we have three luxury adjoining villas. We've got reservations at all kinds of beautiful restaurants and excursions planned. We have a private yacht booked for one day.
I know, it's amazing.
What? I'm so excited about that. So that's coming up in June. And then following shortly after that, we're going to Italy. We're going to be in Tuscany from August 17th to 24th. We have booked this big, gorgeous Medici villa just outside of Pisa. And again, we've got chefs coming in to prepare meals for us and doing cooking classes. And we're doing excursions to Florence. And you're going to do an art tour. And I'm super excited about that, too.
Well, the thing I love about it is that I like to connect with people as individuals. Hard to do at a lifestyle party. Easy when you're on a hike, in a museum, walking side by side with someone for 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and just finding out about them as a person.
Yeah, so if that sounds like your kind of trip, you can find out about those trips, which are unfortunately both full. But we will be hosting more trips in the future. So if you want to be the first to hear about those new trips as they are launched, go to www.sapiotours.com and you can get on our mailing list and you can hear about our trips as they are announced.
And now, back to the Monogamous Marriage Podcast.
So just in the past 2 years, I've started exploring other substances because I've realized that alcohol is not working for me as well as it used to. I have more long-term effects, you know, more hangovers and next day issues. So I thought, what else is out there that I could safely and responsibly explore? So I've looked into non-addictive, mind-altering substances like cannabis, which is now legal across all of Canada, MDMA, which is not technically legal, and mushrooms, which are kind of in that gray area where you can possess a certain amount, but you can't really distribute without proper licensing or whatever. So those are the three drugs I've experimented with in the past couple of years.
Right. So it's interesting, just your very definition, the non-addictive part, it's a complicated issue, don't you think?
Sure.
Because there is an element of physical addiction where there is a craving at the body level to have more and more of a substance, but there's also a psychological dependency. And again, we're not experts. I barely know what I'm talking about here. But that idea that anything you like can be something that you want too much of. So the classic case being with me, sugar. Mm-hmm. So I love it. I don't know if it's addictive as a substance. That'd be for someone else to define.
Definitely
is. I have a very hard time saying no to it.
Yeah. Well, I heard someone say that sugar is as addictive as heroin, that it's got that same level of pull on your whatever. Right. Was responsible for that kind of pull.
And speaking of heroin, it's important to say that we're talking about those three drugs that you mentioned. So basically cannabis, MDMA, and mushrooms. We're not talking about cocaine. We're not talking about heroin.
No
and
opioids.
And other far more addictive substances.
Yeah. I'm not willing to even experiment with something that could get me physically hooked.
Right.
I'm not wanting to go there. So that's part of the responsible use. So a lot of people start trying these drugs when they're young, you know, in high school or college. For us, we were such abstainers in our early life. For me, it was at 45 that I tried illegal drugs for the first time.
I find this fascinating. You know, it's like an inversion of the usual order. So usually drugs are part of youthful indulgence. So it's someone taking risks with their young, resilient body and trying things that are maybe ill-advised, and then later taking a more mature approach and walking away. But for us and for our friends, it's the opposite. They're starting their drug experience in their 40s and 50s. And I just find that fascinating.
Well, I have to think it's a healthier approach.
Sure.
Right. So in your early 20s, your brain isn't even fully developed yet.
Right.
So you don't have great impulse control. You don't have great decision making skills. You don't have a lot of money. So you're probably going to the cheapest source. And you're maybe more susceptible to that peer pressure of, you know, being at a party and being offered a pill that you don't even question where it came from. Right.
Right.
So we've seen in our families both problematic use of drugs when they start right. early. But I feel like for us, because we've established careers and we've raised kids and we've paid our bills and we've done all the responsible things mm-hmm. for us to say, now we're going to try experimenting in other ways. So we've experimented with sexuality and relationship styles. We're also going to experiment with some mind-altering substances, but we're going to do it in a way that feels as responsible as possible, in that we test our substances, we measure them out carefully, we spread out our use in a way that's not going to be, you know, using every day. I feel like that's the best way to do it. And, you know, to be ruled by fear and to be told you can't do this because it's illegal and don't ask any more questions, I feel like we've gotten over that.
Right.
You know, we threw away religion, we threw away monogamy, and I think we can also throw away some of the fear that has kept us from experimenting with these things in the past.
Right. Although I have to say that I don't know that I've thrown away that fear, because for starters, I remember as a young person, so I was born in 1961, so the whole drug revolution was becoming a big social issue when I was a child, 8, 9, 10, and an early teenager. And I remember my mom saying some version of this: don't turn your back in the cafeteria because someone's going to slip a drug in your drink, and be careful in the elevator because someone might jab you with a needle and then you're going to be hooked on drugs for your entire life.
Right.
And where most teenagers hear that and go, yeah, yeah, mom, right, you don't know much, I listened and went, oh my gosh, mom, thank you for letting me know. I had no idea. I am going to definitely make sure that I do not put myself in a vulnerable position where someone can get me hooked on drugs. That's who I was.
Yeah. And how do you feel now?
I feel great, actually. Thanks, mom. like I, you know, it's kind of like alcohol. So it's like my outsider thing. So I look on at people who are experimenting with these drugs, you in particular, close at hand, and I'm fascinated by it. I've seen the great results, but that voice inside me, that weariness, is still there.
And do you think that's still an echo of your mom in your mind and that religious and fear-mongering kind of approach? Or is there something else that you've experienced that makes you nervous about drugs?
Well, there definitely is. So I had a major, major anxiety problem in my life, decades long, started in 1998. I'm just like happy-go-lucky guy. And then one morning, it's a long story that I'm not going to get into now, I just basically fell off a cliff into a pit of horrible, horrible anxiety. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what had hit me. It took me 2 years to crawl out of that. I was okay for another 8 years. And then bam, it happened to me again. And it was frustrating because it was non-specific anxiety. So it wasn't anxiety about something, not about a problem that you could solve, but just a general horrible body response that was so bad. I remember thinking, so this is not saying that I was contemplating suicide, but I remember thinking in a cool, detached way, oh, if this doesn't end soon, one would have to kill oneself because it's unbearable. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to describe exactly what could be that bad when you can't see a problem on the outside, but I do remember how horrible it was. So when I consider anything that's going to alter my hard-won mental psychological equilibrium that I've now regained and generally don't struggle with anxiety at all, I'm really wary. I'm just wondering. I remember we went to a presentation one time and someone said, For many people, their drug use is going to be a life-changing experience that they look back on as one of the most positive in their life. But for some small percentage, it's going to be a trip to hell. And I've never known for certain that I wouldn't be one of that small percentage who have a trip to hell.
It's interesting because the thing that keeps you afraid of substance use is quite often the thing that drives people to substance use. So when you have that intolerable mental state where you just feel like, I can't go on like this or I'll die, a lot of people say, okay, I have to get away from this, so I'm going to try alcohol or drugs to escape. And you went in the other direction. You just toughed it out sober and got to the end and thought, okay, now in order to control my mind, I will never touch anything that could alter my mind.
Well, it is interesting because in that first go round with anxiety, that first 2 year horrible experience, I was given some antidepressants, but also Ativan. And I used Ativan too much because it kind of worked. It would kind of mute the possibility of that kind of anxiety attack. But getting off it, I'm not going to say it was like kicking heroin cold turkey, but it was very bad. So I resolved the next time that I had that struggle with anxiety, again, a 2 year period, I did not take recourse to medication. So that also feeds into my thinking about these substances.
Yeah, I remember in high school when I was going through my first period of panic attacks and suicidal ideation, I've been through a few periods of those in my life. Someone was talking to me about weed and how it just made them feel mellow and calm and chill. And I thought, I can never try that thing because that is exactly the state I want to be in. And I would be one of those people who would get addicted to it. So if there was a thing that could make me feel mellow, calm, chill, happy, I would want that thing all the time. So that's what kept me from doing it in high school. But when I eventually did try cannabis, it actually didn't help me in that way.
Right.
I found it paranoia inducing.
Right. So let's fast forward now to 2020 and we're at Desire. And someone offers you MDMA and suddenly you're ready to say yes. How did that change happen over the years?
Well, I guess it had a lot to do with the lifestyle. So as I said, we had decided very consciously to throw off a lot of the old things that kept us locked down. So we had gotten rid of the rules and regulations and social stigmas and, you know, things that had told us that sex is just for man and wife and that you should be good Christians and all that stuff. So I felt like as part of this throwing off and this new spirit of adventure and try everything twice, which was my new motto, because the first time you probably won't get it right, I felt like, yeah, this is one of those things that I could also try twice. And we were there at Desire. So in a space like that, you're feeling a little more free, like what happens at Desire stays at Desire sort of thing. And this was a good friend of ours we'd known for years. He is a surgeon and I felt safe in his care. It was a batch of M that he had tried himself and with his friends a few days earlier. So he had tested it. And I felt like this is the best situation to try something new, where I've got someone nearby who can revive me if I die.
Right.
And who has access to this, because at that point I had no idea where I would ever get this at home.
Right.
So I thought, well, what the hell? Let's try it.
Right. Now, was it as spontaneous as that? Or do you feel there had been some thinking and mental preparation in advance getting you ready for that moment?
Not anything specific to MDMA, but I had been opening my mind to other kinds of drugs. So I had tried some weed a few different times and it was legal in Canada. And I thought, okay, well, I better check it out, you know?
So let's sidebar for a second. We'll get back to that story about trying MDMA at Desire, but tell me about those weed experiences because you're saying they helped lay the groundwork for you. Were they positive? Were they negative? Were they mixed?
I had had two or three times where someone had offered me a joint. I'd taken a puff and not really felt anything. So I felt like, yeah, I'm kind of impervious to weed. And then we were at Hedo and I took a big, long draw on somebody's joint and was just kind of knocked out. I got couch lock immediately. I felt like I was 400 pounds and I couldn't move off this day. I was panicky. I felt immobilized. I couldn't speak. The whole experience was very bad.
Right.
And so those were my very early experiences, maybe in the 5 years leading up to trying when I was in 2020. So I had kind of decided weed's not for me. But when it became legal, I thought, well, I'm going to try a bunch of different things. I'll try some edibles. I'll try a vape and see if there is a good experience to be had, because so many people were raving about weed. And I just could not find a good experience on it. It was always, it made me feel anxious. It made me feel like I couldn't access my words, which made me more anxious in a social setting. When we would take a little bit from a vape before bed and we would have some good sex, but I found it disturbing in my mind that I would kind of blank out. So my body was feeling good, but my mind kept kind of losing time. And that was uncomfortable for me. And then I would feel very tired in my body, but very buzzy in my brain. So it made my body feel paralyzed, but my brain feel overactive and paranoid. So I've never actually had a very good weed experience.
Right. And that gets to something that we hear a lot with drugs, like completely contradictory effects. So some people will say weed makes me paranoid and more anxious. And some people will say, oh, I can't get to sleep without weed. It relaxes me. You feel like, what are we talking about here? Like, shouldn't it be one person says it makes them more panicky and some person says, well, it makes me just a little bit panicky. Or one gets more relaxed and one gets a little less relaxed. But to be at different ends of the spectrum with the same substance, that gets to, I think, a little bit of the power of these drugs that has to be respected.
Yeah. And people have these powerful experiences and they want you to share in them.
Right.
So I've had so many friends who say, oh, this helps me sleep or this helps me have an orgasm. And they're really excited about sharing this with me because I've expressed problems with sleeping and orgasming. And it just doesn't work in the same way for me. So even when I'm taking the exact same product as this person who has firsthand narrative experience and can say, this is what it did for me, I do not have the same experience of it. So we all have different brain chemistries. I'm also recently on an antidepressant, an SSRI. So that could affect how I experience different kinds of drugs.
Right.
So yeah, there are a lot of factors.
Okay. So let's get back to that episode in 2020 at Desire.
Right.
So I remember it was really in the air. People were looking forward to, we're going to have this party and we're going to do M and we're going to all be together. And we're hearing, I guess, anecdotal evidence of what they expect from the experience based on their past experiences. What was your mindset going into that?
Well, I was open to it. And our friend said, if we do this together, we're going to love each other forever.
Right.
And I thought, well, that sounds lovely. Let's do it. So I don't know. I felt very open to the experience, very trusting of this individual. And I still trust and love him.
Right.
And so he gave me a dose. So it was about 120 milligram dose that he thought was appropriate for my body weight. And as it turned out, it probably would have been the perfect dose for me had it been broken up into two different doses. So if I had taken them like an hour and a half apart, that might have been the perfect amount. But because I started with 120 milligrams and it was fetish night at Desire, so I was wearing tight-fitting corset and collar and thigh-high stockings and boots, I was feeling very confined and hot already. And then we went to the disco. And the drug wasn't hitting. I wasn't really feeling much, maybe just a little bit of nausea. And I was dancing. And then suddenly I got this feeling like I was on fire, like my skin was on fire. I couldn't speak. I was so thirsty. I felt like I couldn't even open my mouth. And I just kind of felt really panicky. Like, what is happening? I'm having an adverse reaction to this drug, clearly.
Right. And I remember observing you, because I knew that you had taken it and you were smiling, but I have enough experience with you that you were smiling like a hostage and the gunman is standing just out of the view of the camera. Like, it was not a spontaneous demonstration of your inner state. That smile was like, I'm dying here and I'm trying not to wreck anyone's evening while I slowly slip from this world to the next.
Right. Yeah. So MDMA It actually stands for methylene dioxymethamphetamine. So methamphetamine, which is a stimulant, is right there in the name. And I was getting the effect of that stimulant in a big way.
Right.
So I was already hot. My skin was already sweaty and the blood was at the surface and my heart rate was already high. So then you add a stimulant on top of that and it was just an overwhelming experience. So my first impression of M was that I don't like it.
Right.
But we did go back to our room and we lay in the cool air-conditioned bedroom. We put on some soothing music and lights and I got my panic under control and my body temperature under control. And then we discovered, oh, this is what M is for, because we started touching each other and eventually having sex. And it was, up until that point, maybe the most extraordinary sex I'd ever had. It just was so revolutionary to me to become aware of some of the senses we have access to that we don't normally use. So when you penetrated me, I could feel the ridge head of your cock. When you came inside me, I could feel the warm spreading spurt.
Wow.
Of your ejaculation. Like, it was crazy. Your smell was addictive. Like, I just kept burying my face in your neck saying, I love the way you smell. Like, it was almost like I became aware of your pheromones, like right. That thing that initially primally attracted me to you.
That is supposed to be subconscious.
Yeah. And so all of these things that, you know, we do have nerve endings that are capable of this level of sensitivity, but we can't actually always be aware of them because it would just be overwhelming to us. So that feeling I had of being on fire, that was just the blood rising to the surface of my skin and me feeling it for the first time.
Right.
And me feeling like I couldn't breathe. I had to think about filling my lungs in a way that I normally don't. So it's just normally an unconscious process. So becoming aware of these things can feel anxiety inducing because it's weird. Like all of a sudden you don't know your body anymore. But it's only because all of your senses have been turned up. And once you realize that's what's happening, and it's not that you're allergic to it and you're going to die, then you can access the pleasure of that. Because when your senses are heightened, there are so many things that feel better.
Right. And that was my first experience of realizing a tremendous drug benefit vicariously. So I too had amazing sex that night, facilitated by your experience of MDMA, because you were a different partner for me. You were more relaxed, giving, and appreciative. And you're a relaxed, giving, and appreciative human normally. But this was on a whole new level. And the sex was just amazing. And I remember one aspect that was a big turn on. We had actually shot a video in the afternoon of you having sex with actually the same guy who gave you the MDMA. Mm-hmm. And I had that footage on my phone. And I thought you'd say, oh, that's terrible. We shouldn't have done that. I got carried away in the moment. And you were so into seeing yourself getting fucked on camera that it turned me on maybe more than anything else I've ever experienced. And then I'm coming to you with that level of arousal and you're receiving it with a level of openness I've never seen. So I'm thinking MDMA may be the greatest drug I never take. Because as long as you're taking it, I get the full experience with no risk.
Right. And that continued to be the case for another couple of years, where very infrequently, I think after that first time, it was about a year and a half before I even tried it again, because mm-hmm. I was scared off by that first half hour or so of the high. And when I did try it again, I thought, okay, I'm going to start low, go slow, which is good advice for a good reason.
Yes.
So I started with half of that dose and let myself go for an hour and a half to feel what that felt like. And then I upped it and did a little bit more. And that was a much more positive experience. That was maybe a year and a half, 2 years later with that same group of people back at Desire.
Right.
And we had a beautiful experience. All of us were out on the beach beds at night and we were basically just fucking our partners and, you know, just kind of touching each other. And at one point I was singing and it was just this beautiful blissed out experience. I was on the beach kissing one of the women and I said, this is the night we fall in love. And it was just so lovely.
Right.
And one of the things I realized was that there were no after effects for me.
Oh.
So normally after a night of drinking, I'd feel dehydrated and tired. My eyes would hurt. I'd have kind of a sick stomach. The next day, there were no ill effects for me with the MDMA. So I thought, this is a way better experience with way less consequences after. Mm. I thought, okay, I'm into it now. This is what I want to try.
Right.
Unfortunately, because it does, you know, cause a big release of serotonin, it depletes your serotonin. So a lot of people have a sense of feeling kind of depressed or down a couple days later because they don't have their normal levels of serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm naturally a low serotonin person, though.
Okay.
So it's almost like I just go right back to being my kind of slightly depressed state, which I always exist in. So I don't feel it as a change from my normal life.
Right. And that brings up an interesting thing, too, because I remember thinking, I think you have validated this perspective, that a lot of what people get from MDMA, a lot of what you got from MDMA, are things that I experience naturally day to day. So by that, I mean like a wonder at the world, a deep appreciation for little details. I'm tuned into those things. And that's not the whole of the MDMA experience, but it's part of it.
Yeah. I remember saying at one point, I feel like I'm finally understanding what it's like to be you.
Right.
That you so often express to me, oh, I'm so in love with you, and you squeeze me really hard. And, you know, you'll say over and over, oh, Kate, oh, Kate, oh, Kate. There's a level of ecstasy you can get to without any kind of drug interventions that I just don't have access to in my regular life.
Right.
So this is where it could become problematic, because even though it's not physically addictive, it could definitely become psychologically addictive for someone like me.
Right.
Who goes through life with a lot of heaviness.
Right.
And to have that lifted for a while is such a relief.
Yeah. How do you not want it lifted permanently?
Yeah. I just want to be that loving, open, patient person all the time, because I know she's in there.
Right.
But so often she is covered over with the more top of mind anxiety and frustrations that come out so
quickly. Perfectionism.
Yeah. And they come out in regard to myself and to the people around me. And I can be harsh and judgy and quick tempered. And when I'm on M, that goes away. And I just feel like, oh, there's me.
Right. So that gets to the point, can drugs be a gateway to showing you a different way of being that you can then access without the drug? Can it be a teacher?
Well, I think we've demonstrated that it can be. So I guess you should maybe talk about your experiences with MDMA, and then we can talk jointly about how it's had an ongoing effect for us.
Yeah, I remember you basically soon after your first experience, or maybe that second experience that was so overwhelmingly positive, encouraging me to try it. And I think from two perspectives. One, as someone who loves me, you just wanted me to have a great experience that you had had. But also, we saw this among our friends too, a kind of communalism that says, I want you to be here with me. Yeah. I don't want to be alone. And because MDMA, while you've had good group experiences, is really an intimate kind of experience. It works really well in a one-on-one situation. It strengthens your bond, makes you more open and appreciative of the other person. So you wanted basically company in that state. And so I was very sympathetic to that argument. So I had this one side of me that still heard my mother's voice in my head and still believed that she was basically right, that these are dangerous things that are best to avoid. And because I am such an appreciator of life, for lack of a better term, I didn't feel the same need to try it, but I did get what you meant about not wanting to feel alone there. So eventually I said, I will try some. And in the spirit of start low and go slow, my first experience, if you have any knowledge of MDMA, usually it's in capsules. You open them up and there's little grains in there that are the chemical. I think the first time I tried it, you could count the number of grains that I ingested. It was almost imperceptible. So I tried it. And you know what? There might have been some heightening of my experience with you. I think this was in just outside of Montreal, right at Mount Tremblant.
Yeah, just last year.
That was the first time. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no negative, maybe a bit of positive, but nothing overwhelming that made me think, oh, I can't wait to try that again. But I did try it again. And I gently increased the dose every time. So I had that experience at Mount Tremblant. It was almost imperceptible, but if anything, slightly positive. My next experience was just a little bit more. It was at home. I don't know that it was perceptible either until on your birthday, we were at a spa and I tried, I'm guessing 40 milligrams or 50 milligrams. So less than half of what you had tried in Mexico, but I had a fantastic experience. So again, you were having the full experience. And instead of me being on the sidelines, so to speak, in the bleachers, I was on the field with you this time. And it was really great. One of the greatest sexual experiences of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So for reference, we can say, you know, you tried 120 milligrams on that first occasion that was so difficult for you at the beginning. So finally, fairly recently, I tried 70 milligrams. So still just more than half of what you had tried. And with my bigger body, it should have been easy.
Yeah. And this was your fourth trip in the calendar year.
Yes.
So we had really spread these things out.
Right. If you can call that experience I had the first time any kind of trip. But yeah, let's call it trip for lack of a better word. And so at 70 milligrams, I definitely felt something. Like I definitely felt an overwhelming closeness to you and a joy in our sexual time together. And I think it coincided with one of our 3-hour sex dates that turned into a 6-hour sex date.
Yeah. And that's when you had your first negative experience. Is that right?
Yeah. The time of taking the drug was great. It was really good. It was like the 40 or 50 gram experience, but even better still. But for the first time, I felt a mild depression the next day. So nothing clinical, nothing dangerous, but definitely a sense that, oh, someone, some force had to be paid back for the good times I'd had the day before.
Right. So in the past, I had said, oh, when I'm on M, I think I feel like you feel. Guess what? When you are off M, you probably feel like I feel.
That's a very good point.
So we each got a little insight into the other's mental state of mind. So I think part of what motivated you to finally acquiesce and say, okay, yes, I want to have this experience with you is because we had been going through that really difficult year of separate dating and then the betrayal of you keeping a secret from me. And you can go back and listen to those episodes. And I was feeling like we needed to do this in order to reestablish trust between us. And for me, I've always felt like you are so unendingly positive that there's got to be something else in there. Like there's got to be a darkness. There has to be some regrets or anger or, you know, self-loathing. And I felt like you put a gloss on everything that made me wonder what else was in there.
And wonder with a sense of fear, not with a sense of joyful expectation.
Right. So I wanted to do this trip with you so that you were open-hearted enough and unafraid enough to share with me any negative things that were in there. Because I know when you're in the headspace of MDMA, you can say things that would normally be difficult to say or be frightening to think about, and they don't feel scary. Mm. So that's why it's such a good therapeutic drug and why it's been used to such great effect with PTSD.
Right. Almost like a truth serum of sorts.
Mm-hmm. But taking you away from the negative feelings that you often have when you, you know, think about or talk about those negative things.
Mm-hmm.
So that was partly what I wanted. I want to crack open your brain and see what's really in there, unfiltered, unedited. And I felt like that would help me trust you more if I knew all that was in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we achieved that. On these trips, especially those last two when you were definitely in an altered state, I feel like I saw the whole of you, and you really are all positive. You really are all love. And Yeah, the thing that you just kept saying over and over again was, oh, Kate, oh, Kate, oh, Kate, I love you, I love you. And it was just this volcano of love. It just came like pouring out of you. And you wanted to kiss me nonstop. And it wasn't even sexual so much as just loving and intimate. And of course, this drug augments that. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like it gave me a reassuring picture of your real love and devotion to me. And the things that I had been holding on to as fears of you being dissatisfied or not really loving me or potentially going to leave me down the line, I feel like it put those fears to rest for me. And that was a takeaway that I hold on to well after the drugs wear off.
Right.
That I saw the real you, and to your core, you are committed to and in love with me. And I feel like I saw it in a way that made me believe it for the first time, maybe.
Right. So that all sounds fantastic. So a big benefit for me of that whole MDMA experience when I had those higher doses that were more perceptible was a complete relaxation of my very strong shame reflex. So I am a human being who walks through the world ready to be embarrassed at any time. So I'm hypervigilant. I govern myself, what I say, how I appear, to a very fine detail for that reason. But it also means that I'm inhibited sexually from asking for what I want, because if what I want falls outside of the commonly prescribed range of sexual tastes that a man like me should have, then there is more risk of embarrassment than there is possible reward of fulfillment. That's how it feels within me. So in that altered state with MDMA, I completely lost that fear. And so part of what made those sexual experiences great was the fact that I could truly ask for what I wanted. And I had someone in you who was very receptive at an almost superhuman level. So the combination of those two made for one of the greatest experiences of my life.
One of the things that was a problem for me when we were going through the separate dating experiment.
Fiasco,
yep. Was that you had said at one point that you had never felt completely free with me sexually. Mm-hmm. And that you could go with these other women who you had no history with and had never been turned down by or judged by and feel free in a way you could not feel with me. And that was so hurtful and frightening for me. Mm-hmm. So I feel like in the MDMA trip, you were able to open up in a way that you had felt unable to access before. And partly that was you being on the drug. So mm-hmm. you felt less fear and less shame and more open. But partly that was me being on the drug with you, because you knew you could bring this to me and I would also be more open and less judgy. And so the fact that we were on it together was what allowed that breakthrough for us, I think. Mm-hmm. And that again was something that we could take away from these trips. And if we never do the drug again, you feel less shame and less apprehension about asking for things. And we've discovered some wild butt play.
Okay, yes.
And I've taken away that I really do believe that you love me and that you're committed to me. And those are massive, massive things mm-hmm. that will improve our relationship going forward. So if MDMA was for us a therapeutic drug, I think it did its job
right
way faster and for less money than talk therapy could have for
right.
us.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting perspective. There was also another possible fallout mm-hmm. from that experience, and that is that 3 days before Christmas this year, so at the time of this podcast, less than a month ago,
which was about 2 weeks after our last MDMA trip,
mm-hmm. I had a TIA, a trans ischemic attack, more commonly known as a mini stroke, while I was driving. And it was thankfully very brief, but it was scary too, mm-hmm. because my brother lost permanently the entire right side of his body due to stroke 12 years ago now. And so knowing that it's in my family makes it scarier. And we were not sure 100% that it could not have been a result of the MDMA use. Unlikely, but not 100% unlikely.
Right. Yeah. So we had an exchange with a man from the Hedo trip last week.
Yeah.
Who was actually, you know, a Johns Hopkins fellow in the Psychedelic Research Institute.
Right.
And now he has his own MDMA therapeutic practice. So we were able to give him some of the details of what happened. And he was able to say, it's unlikely that unless you had the stroke during the trip while you were on the drug, it's unlikely that there's a connection. You know, you're a 62-year-old man with a strong family history. It was bound to happen. But no one could rule out the possibility that introducing these drugs with the combination of the other drugs you're on, see the Erections podcast, that there couldn't have been some sort of ill effect from the MDMA use. And so you've decided that you're just not going to do it anymore.
Yeah, and partly that decision was made easy by an experience we've had since where we were having sex and I had what felt like to me, and I'm sure seemed like to you, an almost identical reaction where just saying your name over and over felt like the sexiest thing. And I had not taken any drug, but like we had hoped, I was now able to access a place of openness because I had been shown it by the drug, so to speak. But now I was able to walk through that door without the drug.
We've noticed an interesting development in the lifestyle where people around us, our peers who are generally successful, professional, responsible adults, are all talking about drugs, MDMA and mushrooms specifically, and everybody seems to be experimenting.
Yes, it's really fascinating. My business partner, who is not in the lifestyle, is someone I've spoken to about this. And I said, so are you finding this among your friends? Everyone's either taken MDMA or they're planning to, or they've had a great experience with mushrooms. And he said, no. So it seemed like, oh, okay, this is just happening within our lifestyle bubble, maybe.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of a Canadian thing because with cannabis being legalized and then these other things being decriminalized, I thought, well, now everybody's trying it because it's available. And I figured it wouldn't just be a lifestyle phenomenon, but a whole cultural phenomenon.
Right. That's what I thought too, but apparently not.
So it seems pretty common now when we go to different lifestyle takeovers that everybody's just kind of on some sort of drug or open to talking about it or offering you something. So for people who are coming in from the outside who have not had that experience, it might feel kind of like, whoa, slow down. This right. is crazy town over here.
Right. Yeah. And so I think the way it works is you just hear enough people who you trust, who seem level-headed and intelligent, talking about their great experiences, and it's kind of hard to resist.
We've also tried mushrooms. Mm-hmm. Mushrooms are mm-hmm. psilocybin. They're a hallucinogenic. So I had that experience with some responsible friends of ours at Hedonism last year. So at Hedo, they have a store called Hedo Weedo, where right. you can go in on site and buy all kinds of different weed products, but also mushroom products.
Right.
So friends of ours bought a mushroom bar, chocolate mm-hmm. bar, and there were six of us, three couples, who all decided to take some together one afternoon. And we set some ground rules in advance where we said we are all going to stay together and travel together. So no one is breaking off to go somewhere on their own.
Right.
And that was kind of a safety measure and a comfort thing. If anybody wanted to move, the whole group would move. So if you started feeling anxious in one place, we would all go together to somewhere where you felt more comfortable. And it was a really beautiful afternoon. We split that one chocolate bar among the six of us. And I don't think anyone had any ill effects, but it was the most mushrooms I had tried. And it was very interesting because there were kind of waves of experience where I would feel totally normal and fine and then feel like, oh, wow, I can see something moving in the tiles in this bathroom as I sit on the toilet. And then at one point, I lay down on the daybed and I asked one of our friends to lie on top of me. And as we were breathing together, I got this almost sensory experience of my energy, cells, aura going into him as I breathed out and his coming into me as he breathed out. And there was this like energy exchange as he lay on top of me, totally naked, totally asexual. And I just felt like we were merging in some way. And it was just kind of beautiful and freeing. And so in the year since, I've tried microdosing a little bit of mushrooms on days when I feel like we're going to do something that makes me normally kind of anxious or frustrated. And it really helps. It just kind of smooths over the rough edges. Right. So I haven't done a hero dose. I haven't, you know, seen anything crazy like visuals or anything. But this past week when we were at Hedo, I decided I'm going to have a no alcohol day. And I bought one of those mushrooms. I shared a little bit with a couple of our friends. And then basically throughout the day, just kept taking little pieces off that chocolate bar. And it was the best day at Hedo. I was happy and easy and everything felt lovely. And, you know, the other two people that had shared the mushrooms with me, we went and had a very sensual massage where we all just touched each other again, non-sexually. I feel like mushrooms are not very sexual in their effects.
Although again, with that sense of contradiction, you'll have people say,
sure,
I have my very best orgasms on mushrooms.
Yeah. Yes, possible. But it was just a really like taking a breath, you know? It was just like, that's how I felt all day long. And every time I started feeling a little more in my head and anxious, I just take another little nibble of that chocolate bar. And then I'd go back to feeling, so nice. Everything is so nice.
Right. So that gets to, I think, an important difference to wrap up this section between alcohol and drugs. So alcohol generally is about people getting into a more relaxed state, but it's about being in a party vibe, so to speak. And drugs are more spiritual, it seems to me, at least MDMA and psilocybin or mushrooms.
Yeah, those psychedelic drugs. One of the things I read talked about them increasing your neuroplasticity.
Okay.
So you have a greater potential for growth and openness, and that persists even after the high is over.
Right. But when we think of alcohol helping someone to be more disinhibited and to have a good time, drugs are something different.
Well, for me, it's much more of a good time.
Right.
So with alcohol, you can get sick in the moment. You can throw up. You can get forgetful.
Right.
Things can happen that you don't remember the next day. You can feel sick the next day. With the drugs I've experienced, there's none of that.
Right.
So I don't feel out of control. I don't feel like I'm forgetting things. The next day, I don't feel sick. At most, you might feel a little dehydrated. So for me, the experience of drugs is, it's less fraught with bad after effects.
Right. Well, when you think about it, no one drinks to get closer to the people they love, to enhance their appreciation of the natural world.
Right.
But that's exactly why people take MDMA or mushrooms.
Right. So it's a connecting thing rather than an escaping thing.
It's coming from a different motivational center in our complex makeup as human beings. So we're going to take one more break and come back and wrap up this episode. I am so excited about an event that I am not even going to be a part of coming up in April.
Right. You are not invited.
I know.
Nor are any men. As part of Sapio Tours, I am hosting a Women of the Lifestyle Wellness Weekend. So April 25th to 28th, it's a long weekend. You'll have to make it a long weekend with work. At the end of April, we are going to meet in a lovely modern mansion on the banks of the Potomac River in West Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. And it will be a group of women who can come together and be creative, be open, and we are going to be facilitated by Catherine of Expansive Connection. So she's a relationship coach. She's going to lead us through some group coaching sessions. She's also a yoga instructor, so she is going to lead us through some yoga classes. I, as a writing teacher with many years' experience, am also going to be leading some creative writing sessions where you're going to do some reflective journaling type activities. And all of these things will allow us to access some of those inner parts of us that are afraid, that feel shame, that are not able to understand what our authentic desires are in this lifestyle, and allow us to share those things with other women who are on the same path, taking the same journey together. And we are also going to have some luxurious elements. We'll have a chef who comes in to make healthy meals for us, breakfasts and dinners. And it's all going to be in a setting that feels a little like summer camp for women. And it's just going to be a wonderful time of sharing and growing and being together in a way that the lifestyle doesn't always allow us to be together outside of the sexual pressures that men might sometimes unwittingly apply.
So if you're a woman who wants to be a part of this event, or if you're a man who's thinking this would be great for my partner, and we've had a few of those men contact us and book the event for their partners, what's the next step?
They can go to sapiotours.com. You can read all about the event there and sign up directly.
Great. Okay, now back to the podcast. So we've talked about alcohol. We've talked about drugs. I've already said my next step is really not to do anymore. My alcohol experiment ended in 2018. I'm pretty sure my MDMA experiment ended in the month of December with the definite reaction of a depressive episode, mildly depressive, but still a hint of negativity that I'm not used to. And the possible, although remote, connection to the mini stroke that I had. So I'm getting off that train. How about you?
Well, I still love the effect of both MDMA and mushrooms. And while I'm sad that we're not going to be able to have those experiences together, I absolutely respect your right to make that choice. And I thank you for going out on a limb and doing something that was difficult and scary for you and trying it with me. I think I achieved what I wanted to achieve in having that experience with you. And so if you try something and say it's not for me, it's totally your right. Mm-hmm. For me, though, I love the effects. When I drink alcohol, I feel icky. I don't even like it. I mean, I like the taste. I like my wine still, but I don't want to get drunk anymore. Mm. And I feel like this day I had at Hedo was kind of a model for the way I want to feel and the way I want to party in the future. Mm-hmm. Just this open, calm, loving feeling is way better for me than being drunk and silly.
Right.
So I'm going to continue to do it in a responsible way. We have a good source now for these things. We've got testing kits and measuring devices, and we're going to make sure that these trips are spread out so they don't screw up my brain chemistry too much. And I will talk to my doctor the next time I'm in as we reevaluate my use of SSRIs. So I want to make sure that I'm doing things responsibly because I obviously don't want to mess up my brain. But I feel like this has opened up for me such a new world of being free of the sometimes horrible place that my brain can be, that I can't give it up yet. So I don't want to wreck my brain, but I also love taking a vacation from my brain because the buzzing anxiety that keeps me awake at night, that keeps me in my head obsessing over things during the day, oh, to get rid of that is just priceless for me. Right. So I think I'm going to keep experimenting in as responsible a way as possible.
Right. And I don't disagree with you. I think for you, that is a responsible choice. So I should do something that is equivalent of what you did. In the first section, we talked about alcohol and you mentioned your personal experience of someone, your sister, really struggling with that. And it's only fair that I relate the story of how drug use has touched my family in an incredibly negative way. And that is with my children. All three of my children have had very, very, very serious drug problems. So one ended up in prison as a result of actions undertaken under the influence of drugs. And he seemed to be on drugs for decades, even though now he's doing quite well. My other son, like you alluded to with MDMA, found that headspace so attractive, he just took it. And this is his own account, so often that he ended up with bipolar. So I don't know if that connection is clinical. So forgive me if you're a doctor or a scientist listening, but that's my son's sense of his own experience, that he brought on his bipolar condition by not overusing MDMA a little bit, but on an epic scale.
Like every day for a year kind
right.
of thing. Yeah.
Yes. And a daughter who struggled with crack. So we're talking about these drugs, and we've seen so much positivity attached to those experiences, and quite rightly so. But I just bring up my experience to reinforce what you did with alcohol, that these substances are incredibly dangerous. They can destroy lives. And it may be the trauma that precedes the use that is the real culprit, but there's no getting around.
Issues.
Yeah, there is no getting around that these substances are very powerful and can be very destructive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say that almost all things can fit in that category, right? Everything can be done in moderation and responsibly, like gambling, like pornography, like sex, or, you know, whatever the thing is that lights you up. You can do that in a responsible way as long as it doesn't take over your life. But then there's the other side of the coin where you can do it to the extent that it destroys your life. And so we know lots of people who have had drugs and alcohol destroy their life. And we know some people who have had gambling and pornography addictions also destroy their life. So I think it's important to not blame the substance so much as the bigger picture of that person's situation as far as their background, their trauma, their mental health, their brain chemistry. There's so many things that go into saying this is good and this is bad and this is harmful and this is safe, right? There are no easy answers.
Right.
And I'm sorry that your kids have gone through that.
Thank you. I'm sorry that your sister is going through what she's going through. During this episode, we talked a lot about our travel business because we're so excited about it. But we want to take a moment to remind you that there are other individuals putting together amazing lifestyle travel opportunities, ones that we have personally taken advantage of in the last 12 months. I'm talking about room77life.com, who runs their Isla Mujeres hotel takeovers. Casual Swingers, who put together unbelievable events every April at Hedonism. Naughty Jim, who put together the Be Better at Being Bad event, also at Hedonism. And Libertine Events, who put together Podcastapalooza, or PCAP, of which we've gone to every single one so far and thoroughly enjoyed them and met some of the best friends in our lives. So keep that in mind as you're considering your travel. If Sapio Tours doesn't work for you, there are other great opportunities available.
Go out there and meet all kinds of people and build your community. If you want to stay in touch between podcasts, you can follow us at The Monogamish Marriage on Instagram, at Monogamish One on Twitter, or you can email us at themonogamishmarriage@gmail.com. If you go to our Twitter or Instagram sites, there are also link trees in our bio where you can find our Patreon, our OnlyFans, and our individual Twitter and Instagram accounts. We would also love for you to like and subscribe to our podcast on whatever podcast platform you use. And if you have time, could you please leave us a positive review? We know that this is asking a lot, but it really does make a difference. Thanks so much. Bye.